actually, before we do that, we have a few tracks coming up. We are going to hear Cave Girl, your band. Yeah. We're going to hear Cave Girl, Bad Times. And then also, we're maybe going to, might be able to get some other Jesus in there. You wanted to.
I wanted to because Catty Yoon put out our first tape. She put out this, not this Napkin Records one, but the Not Well, Thank You. EP.
So what's the order now? Just in case people are wondering what we're going to hear. We're going to hear Cave Girl, your band, playing tomorrow night. Still tickets available. 604-822-2487. 604-UBC-CITR.
Yeah.
And if you're wondering what Cave Girl sound like, well, you can hear it because we're going to play them right now. So we're going to hear some Cave Girl.
Fountain. Other Jesus.
And if there's time, maybe you wanted some Guided by Voices.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. We should. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thanks so much. Anything else you want to add to the people out there at all? Why should people care about Cave Girl? Why should people care?
Because we care.
Because we're DTC.
We're DTC. We're down to chill.
Down to care.
Down to care.
We're down to care.
We're down to care, and you should too.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Cave Girl, and doot doot a loot doo.
Doot doot.
here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Today is Friday, the 10th of October. I'm Morgan Yee, and you're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia, to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website citr.ca. It's 5 o'clock and time for a full hour of independent campus, local, and international news. Today's top stories and segments are our science and technology correspondent Marco's discussion of this week's top science findings. We also have an interview with UBC Professor Kurt Huebner, who spoke with News 101 earlier this week about what Canada can expect from the Comprehensive Economic Trade Agreement, or CETA. Later in the program, news correspondent David Usher brings us a report on the use of social media in the Hong Kong protests, as well as an episode of Wings produced by Frieda Worden, which will conclude our show. But before all this, some headlines for today.
In campus news, UBC student residence fees may be increasing by 20% next year. Managing Director of Student Housing, Andrew Parr, said that the 20% increase in fees is intended to help address the increased demand for housing. The fees will raise an estimated $6.5 million for UBC, money that will likely be used to pay for the maintenance of the existing 9 student residence communities, as well as the construction of new residences like Phase 2 of the Ponderosa Commons, which is set to open sometime in the next 2 years. The increase will only apply to 8-month contracts and not full-year leases, and will be raising term housing rent to between $725 to $778 a month. The increase seems likely to bruise many students who already face crippling living costs in a city as expensive as Vancouver. Many students already opt to live an hour or more away from campus due to the price of rent anywhere close to UBC, with housing costs typically exceeding $800 per month per person. The administration's decision to increase prices will undoubtedly be unpopular, but the real question is whether or not the price will be increased each year from now on.
Also, possible UBC tuition fee increase of 10% for international students has also been suggested. In the same report which outlined the housing fee increase, the administration argued for a 10% increase in tuition fees for international students. The argument being made is that UBC is falling behind other top-ranked universities in what it charges international students to attend. The argument follows that future international students are expected to be subject to a fee as part of a, quote, need to invest in their academic excellence. Both of the proposed fees will be subject to a 30-day consultation process before being finalized.
UBC software bug may have compromised student information. UBC students are now being notified for a 2-year-old software bug that may have exposed their personal information to other students. The glitch in the Student Service Center originated from a November 2012 software update, but remained undiscovered until early this September after complaints from 2 students. The bug was fixed within 48 minutes of being reported. UBC's registrar, Kate Ross, said, quote, "The risk you have been affected by this bug is extremely low," citing a possible 1 per 1,000 users as being affected. Ms. Ross also said that exposure to the bug would not have revealed enough information to endanger student finances. However, concerned students are being advised to review their financial information and visit UBC's IT webpage for more information.
UBC Professor of Medicine is to be inducted into the Canadian Medical Hall of Fame. Dr. Julio Montaner is the Director of British Columbia Public Center of Excellence in HIV/AIDS at UBC and is one of 6 Canadians chosen for this award. His work includes pioneering the HIV cocktail, adopted by the World Health Organization in 2000. The cocktail is a combination of 3 antiretroviral drugs that was introduced in 1995. Patients receiving combination therapy have shown dramatic improvements, including decreased mortality rates and viral loads, and increased CD4 and T cell counts.
Trinity Western controversy continues as graduate appeals to Human Rights Tribunal. A Trinity Western graduate by the name of Bethany Parquette has filed a complaint with the BC Human Rights Tribunal. The complaint was prompted by a rejection email from Amaruk Wilderness Corp., a Norwegian wilderness tourism company. Mrs. Parquette claims her application to work in Canada's north was rejected and that she was, quote, attacked on the basis that I'm a Christian. In the email, Amaruk's hiring manager wrote that Parquette was not qualified and the company's, quote, unlike Trinity Western, embraces diversity and the right of people to sleep or marry whoever they want. Listeners may remember that we reported on the Trinity Western's controversy this spring when it was revealed that all prospective students must sign a covenant with the school prohibiting sexual intimacy outside of heterosexual marriage under pain of expulsion.
The coroner's inquest into the death of Lucia Jimenez has issued recommendations to Canadian Border Services Agency. Lucia Vega Jimenez, Mexican woman who hanged herself in a holding center near the Vancouver airport while in custody of the Canadian Border Services Agency in December 2013. The jury says the CBSA should create and staff a dedicated holding center within a 30-minute drive of the airport. Border agency officials should also monitor holding cells by video. Legal counsel and non-government officials should be allowed into the facility, and bathrooms and sleeping rooms should be made self-harm-proof. They also called for the CBSA staff and all subcontracted security company employees to be trained on suicide prevention. The jury's job was to make recommendations that could prevent future deaths but was not able to lay blame or find fault. Jimenez was stopped for transit fare evasion in early December and arrested by CBSA. And in national news, the first reward in a missing persons case has been issued in Ottawa. Justin Rutter went missing 5 years ago at the age of 14 on October 8, 2009. Ottawa police have offered an award of $5,000 for any information that helps in their search. Rutter may be in Vancouver as someone recently reported seeing him to police.
Those are your campus local, national, and international headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned.
Micro sounds of moss and algae. Compositions rooted in the natural world. Bone whistles, light drums, and antler harps. All make appearances at Sonic Topographies, Vancouver New Music's 2014 festival, exploring intersections of sound, music, and sustainability. Sonic Topographies runs from October 16th to 19th. Visit www.newmusic.org for schedule details.
Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us. Up next, we have our weekly science and technology segment with Marco.
Good afternoon. This is Marco with your science and technology news for Friday, October 10th. In our first story from NASA, Pacific Ocean images by NASA's Clouds and Energy Radiant System on the Terra satellite has been studying deep sea creatures in the Pacific Ocean like anemones at hydrothermal vents. The conclusions from the study are that these creatures are not yet feeling the heat from global climate change. The oceans of the world remain cold in the deep areas, and they have not warmed measurably since 2005. Scientists at JPL, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, have analyzed satellite and direct ocean temperature data from 2005 to 2013. Their conclusions are that the ocean abyss below 1.24 miles, or approximately 2 kilometers, has not warmed considerably in the past 8 years. In the 20 and 21st centuries, greenhouse gases have accumulated in the atmosphere, and this had led to a rise of temperature in the top half of the oceans above the 1.24 mile mark. Global average surface temperatures have been rising also, but lately they have now stopped, even though the emission of greenhouse gases continue. So scientists are wondering, where is the missing heat? For this, They looked deep into the oceans because the previous theory was the bottom half of the Earth's oceans should have been taking up the heat. But with this new study and the new findings, it shows that the bottom half of the Earth's oceans have not been taking up the heat. Scientists realize that when water expands when it is heated, and this has led to rising sea levels around the Earth. This has led to the melting of glaciers and Arctic ice. Scientists expected to find the ocean deeps would also be heated, but they have not. So they are still searching for this missing heat. In medical news, a skin sensor could track your health. Imagine sticking a patch of flexible electronics on your skin that could read your body temperature, monitor your blood circulation, tell you when to put on sunscreen, and it wouldn't leave your skin clammy. This new device, this skin sensor, is made of liquid crystals, 3,600 liquid crystals per square inch, and it detects changes in the skin's temperature. The changes in color shown from the monitor are responses to change in body heat, which means that the skin temperature reflects certain characteristics and illnesses that may begin in a person. The temperature sensing device is a small patch and attaches to a person's skin. John H. Rogers, professor of material sciences at University of Illinois Northwestern, said, tissue near an injury heats up and it becomes inflamed or infected. That is what the heat shows, that inflammation or infection is on the way. The skin sensor senses this. It has a small antenna, attaches to the skin, and it sends a signal and measures distribution and diffusion of heat through the skin. The device is small, doesn't need a battery, is wireless, and is very low cost. So patients could wear the skin sensor at home, and doctors could monitor their health from the person's home. In high-tech news, this is not David Letterman's top 10, but this is my top 9. Top 9 odd ways your tech device might injure you. Number 9 is lightning. When lightning strikes a person, usually the electric current doesn't enter the skin because the skin has a high resistance to electric current. This is called flashover. But with an electrical device in your hand, such as a phone, the flashover is disrupted. A 15-year-old UK girl recently suffered cardiac arrest and total loss of hearing in her left ear when she was struck by lightning because she was holding a cell phone. Number 8 on our list is called PlayStation palmar hidradenitis. It's like a lump or rash on your hands, and this is from holding PlayStation controllers too tight and for too long. A PlayStation spokesman said, and quote, "People should follow common sense when using their PlayStations and not overuse it." Number 7 on our list of injuries from high-tech devices is TV screen and photosensitive seizures. Number 6 is BlackBerry thumb and iPod hand. This is usually known as carpal tunnel syndrome or repetitive stress injuries. The people can gradually injure or strain their muscles, tendons, or nerves from constantly using their iPads or BlackBerry. Number 5 on our list is computer vision syndrome, where people experience eye strain, headaches, or blurred vision. Number 4, death by fake chargers. A Chinese woman was electrocuted and died recently from using a fake phone or a third-party phone charger. Number 3 is tinnitus. This is from using your cell phone for too long. It's usually known as ringing in the ears. Number 2, quiet death from using headphones. Accidents with pedestrians wearing headphones has gone up drastically in the past 7 years. 116 accidents with headphones were reported in the U.S., and 70% of the people die because when they have their headphones on, they can't hear that a car is coming and going to knock them down. And number 1 on our list, we have a problem. Yes, WII. The injury is called Nintenditis, Nintendinitis, or Wii-itis. Using the Wii is physically engaging and leads to sports injuries. These injuries include head injuries, shoulder dislocations, or bone fractures. So take care when you're using your high-tech devices. Just the other day in Space News, the lunar eclipse left the moon glowing blood red. On October 8th at 3:15 a.m. Eastern Time, a total lunar eclipse occurred that lasted approximately 1 hour. The edge of Earth's shadow began to pass over October's full moon at 1:15 a.m. Pacific time, which is 4:15 Eastern time. Then at 3:15 a.m. Pacific time, the moon turned a blood red and lasted like that for 59 minutes. In Eastern Canada, the skies were cloudy, but in Western Canada, people had a better view, except, of course, in Vancouver or British Columbia. The blood moon is when a moon turns reddish because the moon passes into Earth's shadow. The moon turns red because it's the same process that goes on when you see the Earth's sky is blue. It's called Rayleigh scattering. Wavelengths of blue light are approximately the same size as the molecules in the air, so these blue wavelengths get repeatedly scattered. The sunset is red, though, because the blue light is scattered out of existence because it is because the light goes through a thicker part of the atmosphere when the moon is setting. This total lunar eclipse brought out meteors from the Draconoid meteor shower, but I doubt if we saw it here in Vancouver. The final two total lunar eclipses of the tetrad, that's four lunar eclipses in a row, will take place April 4th and September 28th, 2015. This is Marco. You have been listening to Astro Talk, Science and Technology News.
Thank you, Marco. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments here on CITR 101.9 FM.
The 9th Independent and Nonpartisan British Columbia Electoral Boundaries Commission wants your input on the area, boundaries, and names of provincial electoral districts to be used for the next two provincial general elections. This democratic process is a unique opportunity for British Columbians to provide their views about how their communities are represented geographically in the Legislative Assembly. Views, submissions, and presentations may be made through an online submission form at www.bc-ebc.ca, by email to info@bc-ebc.ca, or by mail to Post Office Box 9275, Station Provincial Government, Victoria, BC, V8W9J6. All submissions must be received by Sunday, November 16, 2014. Visit the Commission's website to learn about the Commission, how to join a public hearing, view current electoral district maps, and provide input at www.bc-ebc.ca.
Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca. Broadcasting from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us. Up next, we have an interview that I conducted earlier this week with Professor Kurt Huebner, who spoke with me about what Canada can expect from CETA, or the Comprehensive Economic Trade Agreement. Thank you for being with us here on News 101.
Thank you.
So for students who don't know, what is the Comprehensive Economic Trade Agreement?
Yeah, it's an agreement between the European Union, its 28 member states, and Canada. It's long in the making. It was now 6 years ago when all this thing started. It's an agreement that would go far beyond, in many respects, what we know from NAFTA. NAFTA is our agreement with the US and Mexico. And at the time when it was launched, there were a lot of debates and actually struggles in Canada whether we should open up to those partners or not. Now, with the European Union, it's something similar. It's only large in the sense that out of a sudden, the provinces are on board to explain that trade policy is more or less in the hands of the federal government. They can sign, they have to sign all those kind of agreements, but if it comes really materializing all those kind of elements, then the saying is by the provinces. So if they're not on board, you know, you have an agreement, but nothing happens. So that's the first time actually in Canadian history that provinces are part of this of an agreement, and it covers from public procurement, investment, all kind of trades of goods and services, partially the mobility of labor, at least in terms of professional labor. It comes with standardization, recognition of degrees. I mean, this is all kind of promises. Some of those things will be materialized immediately. Some of them will phase in over the next couple of years.
The Canadian government's website says that CETA will, quote, open new markets to our exporters through the EU and generate significant benefits for all Canadians, end quote. As you mentioned with NAFTA, there has been a lot of criticism of this deal. So what impact do you think CETA will realistically have on Canadians?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, Canada is running a trade deficit with the European Union since quite a while. So anyway, we are importing more than we're exporting. This already shows if there is more liberalization, you know, the overall macroeconomic effect may be not so positive than it has been demonstrated or argued by our government. Still, it opened up opportunities and also provides challenges. I mean, CETA is more or less a kind of a deal where the Canadian population at large, if they would be more included in those kind of agreements, that's a critical point because, you know, it's happening in the somewhere. We don't know a lot about it, but let us assume we would know more about it and make over time this may happen. Then we have to make decisions. To which degree do we want, like, open markets? You know, when we are used to, for example, we are now using in front of us our sitting laptops, they're all made not in Canada, they are made somewhere else. You know, in many respects, we are used to make use of those products and services. And and in other respects, you know, let us say if there would be milk on the table or if you would like to have a cheese, that's highly protected because we have a very kind of protectionist system in those areas in Canada. So CETA would open up the market, not radically, for example, cheeses, I love cheese. So if there would be more European cheeses available and cheaper, because now it's a luxury, who can afford a good cheese? It's really, you know, you have to think twice about it. If this would change, and it's changing with CETA, then we'd have more options. So more options, I think, so they are good. In this respect, you know, we are, and it's not that our supply system in Canada would be destroyed. It's only opened up a little bit, so it's not not a big liberalization. In other areas, there will be tariffs coming down to zero. There are calculations done by a so-called joint study from 2009 that Canada, those are the figures the Harper government is always referring to, but this was 2009, it's pretty outdated, you know, whether it's the same, you know, we can expect those kind of figures, we shouldn't take them literally, but they would tell us more export opportunities bring more income, more jobs. At the same time, it may be possible they're losing also jobs, you know, so that's so what's the kind of the balance, how it's looking like, it's difficult. I would argue, in terms of trade and goods and services, not to talk about the other elements, you know, CETA is a greater opportunity. We should look more open to it. There are benefits in terms of more options for consumers. Some of the stuff will get cheaper, definitely for us. So that's good. Whether Canada is able to make use of European markets is another thing. You know, in this regard, I'm a bit more skeptical due to the fact that here in Canada, are turning in the last couple of years at least towards this kind of resource-based economies. You know, and there's a lot of concerns in Europe in terms of the environmental issues. And I think so in many respects they are correct, even though our governments are trying to produce a different kind of image. But in Europe there are huge concerns about the tar sands in Alberta and so on. And those are ideas that they would export those kind of things easily to Europe. Whether this will happen, you know, I'm a bit more skeptical in this regard.
Now, it's been widely reported that Germany had some issues with the investor-state dispute settlement aspect of CETA. Can you explain a little bit more about how realistic those concerns are? What's been reported a lot is that, you know, this could really derail CETA, but it's my understanding that it has already been, like, negotiations are done. It just needs to be ratified. So how likely is it that Germany wouldn't ratify this treaty?
Right. Yeah, yeah. I mean, unlike it has been presented over the last couple of years, CETA seems, I mean, there's still a struggle going on in Europe, but it seems to be necessary that it will be ratified by all, not only by the European Council and the Parliament, but also by the Council of the European Union, to say, and the European Parliament, but also by the 28 governments. So that came up as a kind of surprise from many, even though experts were more or less expecting that this would happen. Means there's always this element of uncertainty. You know, you have to bring it to the 28, and to whatever concerns are coming up, this may be derailing the whole thing. I wouldn't go so far. Even including the German case, and that in Germany, very late made the point that the so-called state or investor-state dispute mechanism may undermine political democracy. And there's a very it's a very serious element, and the whole concern came up actually with TTIP, that's the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Agreement with the U.S. that is negotiate. You know, nobody in Europe would expect something bad from there, from Canada. But as soon as the U.S. comes into the game, things are different. And all of a sudden, CETA, in some respect, is a kind of victim, or could become a victim of TTIP, because then people were looking, oh, CETA has the same kind of elements, like they would like to negotiate for TTIP. Therefore, this drives the concerns in Germany. Two reports have been produced by the Ministry of Germany that is responsible for dealing with CETA only a couple of days ago. And one is making the case, no surprise, that Germany would say, we need to ratify it with our parliament. It will need to be ratified by the German parliament. So that's the kind of thing. Now the question is, what is happening there? And then they presented a second study. And in CETA, I have to say, the hurdles for private businesses to bring governments to private courts, the hurdles are pretty high. Already the CETA text is including some of the critics that came from inside Canada, but also from Europe. So I think so, this kind of language that has been chosen reflects already kind of compromise. They will already look at it. It's in, it's not out. We weren't successful to get it off the whole kind of pages, but the language is so soft and it makes it so difficult that we can live with it. And so that's currently the kind of line I would expect. So the investor state dispute mechanism, first of all, includes or brings forward private courts. You know, if a private investor has problems, let us say with environmental regulation in, let us say, France or so, they say, you know, it's too harsh. It's not. It makes our investment invaluable and all those kind of things. They could go in a pure system. They could go to this private court. Then are all kind of legal advisors. They make a lot of money. All kind of legal person, and then governments, even they are elected in a democratic way with a particular kind of program, they would have the problem really to act properly.
And there were documents that were leaked in August, which were purportedly chunks of CETA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And something that was brought up a lot in local media was a section that seemed like it would make it harder for municipalities to have buy local policies. Mm-hmm. Would that actually impact, you know, Vancouver's ability to, like, we're going to support these initiatives over European initiatives?
Yeah, but that's a so-called public procurement element. It's opening up public procurement. There were thresholds, communities, cities, and some, they were able still to prioritize local producers or disregard if they are doing something up to particular kind of amounts. I think so, like 15 million, 2.5 million, 50 million, something. And that's bigger projects, then it's a kind of open competition. The labor mobility element in CETA in conjunction with public procurement only means that they would, unlike today, it would be much easier for them, let us say, to bring in 20 highly qualified engineers to work on this project. They would allow to come in for a couple of months, kind of the regular.
So more like consultation.
Yeah, okay. Without this big visa kind of things, but they are not allowed to bring in workers. I mean, that's also kind of different element. Like for example, we are outside trade agreements. There are some of the Chinese companies would only bring in investments if they're at the same time allowed. That's this kind of private thing they're doing. If they bring in 2,000 Chinese workers, you know, that's really taking away jobs. With CETA, this is not really
that's not really a threat to Canadian employment.
No.
And I guess my last question for you in the context of the News 101 show is why should UBC students pay attention to this?
If CETA it needs a couple of years until it's really then moving along, and not only due to the ratification, only until all this is becoming reality, it opens up enormous opportunities for students who are open-minded, language skills equipped. They don't have to look any longer only for job opportunities in Canada and, let us say, U.S. There is now a different kind of a big market, Europe, where you can get engaged in the private sector, but more and more, I'm pretty sure, also then in kind of public sectors.
Do you think you'll see more students enrolled in, like, European studies once this
It's not by chance that UBC decided, even though it's a kind of unbalanced situation at the moment, but that UBC decided that out of the three regions, we want to develop collaborative ties. It's China, it's India, and it's Europe.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay, more than welcome.
Up next on our show, we have news correspondent David Usher's report on the use of social media in the Hong Kong protests.
I'm David Usher, CITR 101.9 FM 1. This is News Group, of which each one of us spends a brief few minutes discussing a topic of news interest. The effects of social media, a discussion of differences. Well, first of all, what's meant by the word differences? An example, in Hong Kong today being October 8th, the Occupy Space movement, as quoted from CBC News, is organizing hour upon hour to attempt to persuade Beijing to agree to the terms that they contracted with Great Britain some years ago. And this was when Great Britain gave Hong Kong to China under the contracted understanding that the city-state was to be free in all matters except for military and health. We want Beijing to keep to its terms. Beijing consistently refused, implying that dispersal of the occupying space is paramount, or they may be forced to do something or other. They are intensifying and censoring. Well, for one thing, as this gets more and more intense, they're censoring all social media in China to make sure that the word doesn't get out what's going on in Hong Kong. The leader of the group in Hong Kong, he's maybe, very young anyway, about 20 years old, 19. And how many people are there? It varies from a few thousand up to about 500,000 or more. He says tremendous social media free. Why? Via satellite imagery around the world. Hong Kong being the leader in Asian financial market, and effectively it amounts to it and London as leaders of the market, and the market is responding, and generally by bits and pieces going down, sometimes a little bit up, but generally down, especially the Asian market. Naomi Klein. I only met her once when she was 8 years old, so it doesn't really count. She's now 44. She tends to speak a lot. Her voice seems to carry a lot of weight. When I talked about differences, well, she talks about corporations, about social media itself, about all sorts of things, especially about, I could say, big people, when I guess of the, hundreds of billions of dollars, whether it's oil, pharmaceutical, whatever. As you might expect, at 44 and before that, she's not in favor of any of them.
Thank you, David. To conclude our program, we have an episode of Wings, brought to us by the NCRA Program Exchange. Today's episode is called Peacecast and was hosted and produced by Frida Worden.
On September 11th, 2001, people all over the world were horrified by the attack on the United States. For many women, their first thought was to talk with each other of peace and how to preserve it.
My daughter called me. She was at work and said, "Put your television on," because I was working at my computer.
Huguette LaBelle of Canada, one of the world women leaders who met online September 24th to 27th, 2001, to discuss the current crisis.
I put the television on just prior to the second plane landing in the second tower, and I felt that the world that we have known, with all its many imperfections, the world was being changed with a sense of tremendous insecurity. And the fear that the retaliation would start a cycle of vengeance and counter-vengeance. And tremendous sadness fell over me that was very overpowering at that time.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service. One of the innovations of our time is netcasting, the ability to create radio on the Internet. Feminist International Radio Endeavor, which does this regularly, has joined with Wings in a series called Peacecasts. In its second week, the Peacecast was joined by the Women's Learning Partnership, which hosted a series of conference calls for the Netcast. You'll hear excerpts from those 4 hours of discussion in this half hour of Wings.
I had just landed from Durban, South Africa.
Azza Karam of Egypt directs women's programs at Religions for Peace, based in New York. She was one of many people returning that day from the UN World Conference Against Racism in Durban.
In the taxi on the way from the airport to my home, I saw the first plane go into the World Trade Center. And I thought for a second, this must be an enormous screen projection of a really stupid Hollywood movie. I mean, that was just a moment of absolute shock and denial. And the next immediate thought that came into my mind was, oh my goodness, I have just stepped out of a plane that looks exactly like this. I rushed upstairs to home, and I turned on the television, and thank heavens had the presence of mind to call my parents in Cairo and to say, I'm okay, I'm fine, but you're going to hear some horrible news. Just listen to the news. And then my parents were watching what was happening and literally weeping with just incredulity and horror.
Women's Learning Partnership, which organized the 4 days of conference calls for the Peacecast, is headed by Manaz Afkami, an Iranian exile. She first heard about the attack from Palestinian women.
When this happened, we were at the Women's Learning Partnership conference call with our partners in Palestine. Right. Someone passed a note to the participants on that side, and they told us. And of course, they were very grieved, but at the same time, they were concerned, they being in the war zone and having daily experience of violence and terror, were very much concerned now how is this going to affect them in terms of violence.
As former head of the Canadian International Development Agency, Huguette Labelle was very conscious of the implications for hatred.
Living in Canada, where we have a very large multicultural community from around the world, we were really taken aback by an incident where a young Muslim boy on his way to school was beaten. We feel that we're quite a tolerant society, and yet we say if that can happen at our doorstep, then it can happen in other places in our country, it can happen around the world. And there has been a lot of concern. Groups put pages in the newspapers, and our prime minister went to a very large ceremony in the mosque to tell his compatriots, let us work together and make sure that nobody paints with a brush any one community, because nobody has monopoly on violence.
Azza Karam, Director of Women's Programming for Religions for Peace.
Everything that Religions for Peace stands for is very much coming into play right now. In other words, the necessity of distancing religions from these kinds of activities, and at the same time, the necessity of being able to rally all the religions together, not only in condemnation of terror and violence, but even more importantly, in this particular time, also to speak for the need for a measured, just attitude, response, activities, so that there is a notion that there has been many people who have been wronged, but at the same time, there is also the need to proceed with two concerns in mind, the first being justice, the second being rationality, reasonableness, and the rule of law. And Religions for Peace is trying to mobilize the religious communities around the world to realize their constituencies are experiencing a great deal of lack of clarity, stereotypical images, and a lot of violent rhetoric.
I had boarded a plane from Paris to Washington, D.C. on that day.
Suher Azouni is a Palestinian and former director of the Women's Technical Affairs Committee, a coalition lobbying for women's rights in Palestine and the Middle East.
It was 5 hours after the plane took off that pilot told everybody that there is an emergency situation in the United States and the plane will not land in Washington, D.C. Instead, it will land in Canada. And we were terrified and puzzled, and then we started listening to the BBC and we learned about the horrible event that took place. And then after 6 hours of flight, the airplane landed in Halifax, and we
stayed in the plane for the next 12 hours. And then at midnight, they took us out and we went in big buses to a military training camp called Aldershot. We spent there the next two nights in big rooms with bunker beds, mixed toilets and showers. The Canadians were wonderful to us. But there were six planes that landed there, and I was the only Arab among all the passengers. And I was really terrified because everybody was looking at me as if I was the accused. And the next day, one of the American ladies that shared the bunker bed with me told me that she doesn't want me to be offended, but she was scared because I came from that part of the world. I felt really bad because of all these horrible atrocities that happened in Washington and New York, and I was really so saddened by the stories, and I was following the news, and I was also saddened because it also brought more misery upon us as Arabs and Palestinians, because now we are becoming the accused, even though we really feel more with the Americans, because we have all through our lives experienced many horrors. We have been bombed, we have been shelled, and we know exactly what it is when you lose a loved one. I have to say that I have really great respect and love for the American people. And the person who told me that she was afraid of me ended up being my best friend after the trip was over. I had to go back to Washington, D.C., and also going back, I was so worried and concerned that they would really treat me badly at the airport. But no, they gave me an American flag like everybody else. I spent the last week in bed, mostly sleeping because I was traumatized. But now I'm following up on the news and hoping like-minded people who love peace and who believe in human rights get together to do something about what is happening.
Charlotte Bunch directs the Center for Women's Global Leadership at Rutgers University. She lives in New York.
I don't know how much this is making it into the mainstream media, but one of the ironies and contradictions that we live in New York is that while this is ground zero for the attacks, and also there have been a lot of very warmongering statements, at the same time, in many ways, it's been ground zero for peace activity, with very moving statements of both individuals and organizations trying to call on our own government not to make a militaristic response. Groups like New Yorkers Say No to War and many other groups have held vigils almost every day, and there's now a big demonstration planned this weekend in Washington and another one the following weekend in New York. So although the press tells us that 70 or 80% of the people support Bush, this is not my experience on the ground in New York. What I see is people really struggling to respond to this warmongering rhetoric of the president and urging him to use the United Nations, to use international human rights law and mechanisms to make a response. And secondly, I see a struggle going on nationally. We think that the Bush administration could use this occasion to curtail civil liberties for people, particularly for people of color in the United States.
Thank you, Charlotte.
Aruna Rao from New Delhi, India, a scholar studying gender and institutional change and director of the Gender at Work Collaborative.
I, too, have been struck, not, I must say, from the mainstream media, because it hasn't really been carried very much about the peace activities that are going on there in New York and in other parts of the U.S., but I saw one small clip on CNN where the parents of someone who had perished in the World Trade Center bombings were saying, "Not in my son's name." That was very moving, that someone who's lost so much could say that. What I'm hearing basically from my email connections from around the world is, how do we make this voice a larger voice?
So many countries, including Nigeria, have people who are dead or missing in these attacks. But it's seen as an attack on America and not an attack on the peoples of the world.
Ayo Obe joined the Women's Peace Cast from Nigeria, where she is president of the Civil Liberties Organization.
One thing very clear to those of us who are not in the United States is that when this is seen as an American tragedy, the whole expression of it is inclusive of America, but what seems to be a quite narrowly defined America, and exclusive of others. And I think that whilst one can't expect everybody to always say, oh, America and the rest of the world, I think that what comes through is that there are only certain people that can really be trusted. I heard on the radio there was not going to be racial profiling of passengers and so on, but we have heard passengers have been taken off planes in handcuffs for having a beard and being brown-skinned or getting up in a plane to the bathroom and so on. And I think that it's a very, very difficult thing to understand how this is going to be approached, because I think that for those of us outside, we also see that one of the things that makes America great is the fact that it has been open to new ideas, to new people, to immigrant communities. And I think that it would be a pity for the United States if it were to lose that input.
Joanna, I wanted to ask you a question about civil liberties in Canada also. I've read numerous statements from Arabs in Canada talking about ramification of undermining civil liberties in Canada. I hope this is not the case right now.
I would love to give you a very positive answer.
Joanna Kerr, Executive Director of the Association for Women's Rights and Development in Canada.
But I think that many of the similar situations which are occurring in the U.S. are also happening in Canada in terms of the loss of, or the potential loss of, certain civil liberties. There are many, many groups who are trying to speak out on behalf of any group who's going to be particularly targeted. And certainly there is not a consensus amongst the Canadian public in terms of military action. About 50% of Canadians are interested in military action. That is on the condition if they saw that it would lead to more attack or potential attacks on the Canadian public. But indeed, you're right in the sense that this needs to be very much a global strategy where women and men are really trying to come up with a much more progressive, analytical, and cautioned response. Most certainly I feel that one of the key factors is for us to really re-examine the ways in which our governments and our leaders allow hate to thrive.
We should think of terrorism on a broader perspective.
Jacqueline Pitangui was a leader in rebuilding women's rights when the dictatorship ended in Brazil. She now directs a group called Citizenship, Scholarship, Research, Information, and Action.
I was thinking of state terrorism. We don't talk much about state terrorism, but for instance, so many countries in Latin America and in Central America, in South America, Brazil, Chile, Argentina, we have lived the horror of state violence. We live today and we see today people living under extreme poverty and people who are also submitted to a terror of losing their own civil identity, like Afghanian women. And I just want us to think of this moment, this horrible moment where symbols of the USA were hit, but human beings lost their lives, as a moment that we can also think backwards on our own memories of insecurity and go forward.
I go back to my experience in CEDA.
Huguette Labelle of Canada, former head of the Canadian International Development Agency.
And when you look at where the conflicts in the world have been and the origin of terrorist activity, it is very, to a high proportion, in some of the poorest countries of the world. And I think that if we don't deal with the root causes of conflict, whether it is poverty, illiteracy, and nurturance of ignorance, in a sense, when you put people in a terrorist camp, they're very often isolated from the rest of the world and nourished only one kind of diet, which is one of hate. So I think that the opening up communities to each other, mutually supporting each other, I think is vital, and trying to mobilize, to suggest and press for the kind of approach which will not create a new cycle of vengeance and which will deal with the root causes of these issues.
From the work that we do, it's very clear that there's a different kind of leadership that is needed.
Aruna Rao from India.
To begin to address root causes of these symptoms we're seeing. And I've seen that kind of leadership most eloquently, and I've heard most eloquently voiced by women. And it comes from a place of connectedness. It comes from a place of understanding our differences, but also how we interconnect. And it comes from a place of compassion and a spiritual place as well. As well as being rooted in an analysis of these root causes and a quest for justice. And that's the kind of leadership that we need to make more visible. But where are the women in all of this? The voices are there on the email to some extent, but in the mainstream media in India, I don't see very much of that. And
calling on her phone, I've got no time to be alone. Summer coming at me all the time. You better think I lose my mind, 'cause I'm stranded on my own. Stranded far from home. All right,
thanks for tuning in. This is Stranded, the Australian Canadian music and talk show. I only recently sort of changed the name of the show to Music and Talk Show because I realized that I really do try to get